Hey, Nick, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on today. It's absolutely the case. Back when I started this show, I was in a conglomerate, a multi-company conglomerate, a holding company. We had like four companies within that conglomerate, and one of them was a marketing and media development company that I was serving as the president of. And we had a client, and he wanted a blog and a podcast and all this stuff. And I went out and talked to him and sold him on it. Got the purchase order from him and brought it to my developer and said, "Here we go. Here's our next job." And he looked at me and said, "Well, I don't really know how to do a podcast. I can do all the rest of this stuff." And I'm like, "You know, I've been kicking around some ideas. I'll figure all that out, and I'll take care of getting that part done for you," because it was actually really easy to do with some plugins and WordPress. And we were building the blog in WordPress anyway, so it was pretty simple. But I started doing the show in my car. June 20th, 2008 was the first episode. And after about a week, I decided I was going to keep doing it because it was fun. I'd get home and I didn't want to punch a hole in the wall anymore. And and it was like within a couple months, I was like, this is really getting some traction. I only had a couple hundred listeners, but I'm like, I could tell, like, I was finally doing what I really was meant to do. And it was letting me do what I always really enjoyed most, which was teach. And at the same time, I could tell that it was going to scale. I didn't know what the revenue model was going to be yet, but I kind of took my people on a ride with it. Like, after a while, I decided I was going to do it full time. And I started telling people that on the air, and it kind of got them on board with the whole concept of, like, if you want this show to become what it can become, then I need your support and share it with other people. And about a year into it, I was ready to walk away and actually take it full time in a year. And one of my partners in the conglomerate asked me if I would take over as the COO of one of the other companies that had some real problems and kind of deal with those problems till the end of the year and do my best for them, and then walk away kind of under more of a good grace type thing. And I agreed to do it. So I ended up going full time after 18 months. And it was that January then that I did my first episode where I was actually in a studio, if you want to call it that. It was an extra room in my house. But the whole first 18 months was done in a 2006.5 Jetta Diesel TDI, which I called my personal mobile studio. And there was a guy, Chris Future. Chris Future was the guy way back in the day doing like a libertarian themed podcast, and he was doing it in his car. And I'm like, he can do it in his car. I can do it in my car. So that's kind of how it all started. It was me rolling down the freeway, and the sound actually got pretty good. Like the first couple of episodes, I had this crappy little like multifunction. It was a camera, it was an audio recorder. I didn't even have a microphone. It had a built-in microphone. I just had it sitting in my lap. And that was just to see how this whole thing worked. And you can still go back and listen. I didn't take it down or anything. That episode's still there. But then within about a week, I went out and spent a whopping $20 on a Plantronics headset. And I bought a little Sony MP3 recorder. And once I did that, the audio actually got pretty decent. It's not the level that it is now with a condenser mic and all that, but it was, nobody was like, "I can't understand you, I can't hear you." I'd get one ass clown here and there that would complain about the audio, and I'm like, "Well, then you're not listening to the message. I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about all the people that like what I'm doing and kind of dig the whole kind of guerrilla level of podcasting." And but I didn't do anything really special. Yeah, absolutely, I do. I still get requests like, when you go on vacation, why don't you do a road trip one? And I still have occasionally done stuff. I've done, rapid fire Q&A when I've had like a co-pilot in the vehicle with me, where we'll have people feed me questions on Facebook while I'm driving, and I'll rapid fire answer them. And people love it. I think that I mean, you have to think about it. You say NPR quality level, but when I think of NPR, I think of like the, you know, the SNL skits that are like, welcome to fresh air. And a lot of those people are boring as heck. And I don't think people really listen to a talk show and sit there and go, I want to pick out every little, you know, mess up or scratch or what have you. I mean, even now, I'll warn your audience, you might hear my granddaughter cry any minute or one of the dogs bark or something. I don't strive for audio perfection. I strive for the quality of the content itself. And that's what's most important. Just think about it this way. If somebody was talking like this, you'd want to kill yourself. And you'd be like, please say what you have to say. And you'd tune them out pretty quick. But if you were sitting on a, you know, on a donor list waiting for a heart, and that person was going, the very next heart will be given to, you're paying attention to every word because the information is important to you. So I think it's the quality of delivery. I think it's the how important the information is to your audience. I think if you want to do a sports podcast, you know, reviewing NFL games or something, I think you might need to worry a little bit more about production quality. But if you're doing kind of a variety show and really talking to people, I think you can get away with it. I think it should be a the same thing it was for me. It should be a, I'm doing this because I have to, and we're going to transition at some point to where I don't have to. I mean, I've done little side podcasts. I used to have a bunch of ducks I take care of, and I did one that I did like 100 episodes of that I was taking care of my ducks and dumping water out and just chatting with the audience. And, you know, I didn't try to make that into something big, but it, you know, it was successful for what it was designed to be. So you'd think it'd be hard to come up with something to talk about every day. First, let's go back to my professional career. I came up in the world of sales and marketing, and I was the regional sales vice president for a company called Fluke Networks for quite a few years for the Northeast region. And I would have to go talk to 500 people about testing cables and explaining concepts like near and far end crosstalk. If you can make that interesting, you can make it. I mean, that is literally the most dull thing. So I'd spent my whole life doing public speaking. You know, some of it wasn't quite that dull, but I learned to become a dynamic speaker so that they would like ask you back and people would buy stuff. So I had the skill set of being a presenter anyway. And then the topics were centered around, you know, I did modern survivalism, but this is at a point in time where if I would have called it something like the Lifestyle Design Podcast, nobody would have listened to it. But the concept of survivalism and prepping was really coming into its own at that point. So that was a hook. But I have an incredible broad breadth of space to go across. There was a little more current events and politicky stuff like that in the beginning, just because there was always something new out there. But I tried to make most of the content as evergreen as possible. And then the beauty of it is, as you build an audience, they'll just keep, you know from doing it yourself, they'll feed you, like, who's going to be your next guest? Well, I'm probably going to be told who my next guest is by the audience. Now, after 18 months of doing that, it was very nice to be able to transition to where I could do an interview or two a week. That does make things easier, as you know. But right now, the way I run on a scheduled programming, on Mondays, I do a listener feedback show. So the audience creates that for me. So I'll get 400 or 500 emails and pull out 10 of them, and I'll address those emails. And there could be some current events, some news. It could be direct questions. You know, what kind of gun do I buy? How do I grow my garden? You name it. Tuesdays, I still do a monologue show. I do a standalone show on whatever I'm interested on that particular day. Some days that show has a week of prep into it. Some days, like today, 10 minutes before I started working on it, I was text messaging one of my expert council members. She said, why don't you do something on libertarianism and self-ownership? I'm like, I can do that. So I just created that show on the fly. And you know, 18 months doing it in a car made it where I was able to do that. Wednesdays, I do an interview show. So I'll have a guest on. Thursdays, I do a listener call show. I have an 800 number that people call and a thing called SpeakPipe. So people call their questions in. That's easy because you pull out the question, you record an answer, you drop it into your editor, and you spit it out at the end. And then Friday's my coaster show, right? I decided over time I wanted a day where I didn't have to work so hard. So I found all these great guests over the years, and some of them had been on enough times, I moved them into something I call the expert council. And so people will send in questions for them. I have a guy that, like, you know, professionally builds off-grid solar houses. I have a person that, you know, is big into side hustles and does a coffee business and web design and stuff like that. I have a person that's a full-time farmer. I have a person that's a vet. I have a person that's a doctor. So we'll have questions come in for all these people, and I'll pull out about six of those a week, and I'll take one question myself that day. And so that day's real easy because I'll just, like, we have a question for Doc Bones on, you know, dealing with scleroderma or whatever, and just drop his deal. And so it turned into this. But yeah, in the beginning, it was just, what can I talk about? And the audience never let me down once there was one with ideas, thoughts, and things to talk about. So iTunes was really, you know, a beneficial platform to be on. I think it still is, but at the time, it was the podcast platform. So within like a week, I got approved by the iTunes police or whoever they are, and I started to pick people up right away. But, I mean, it was like, you know, a dozen a week, two dozen a week, something like that. And so that was kind of a natural thing. There was a social media sort of kind of thing back then called StumbleUpon. I don't know if they're still around, but they actually had a survivalist category. And they allowed demographic targeting, like males, you know, 21 to 45. You know, it was just perfect. And it was cheap. And it was like a plug-in to like a browser where you'd say, I like these 10 different things, and you'd click it, and it would just randomly show you stuff. I used that. I used Google AdWords at the time. I would spend, $100 a month buying a little bit of traffic. And so that just gave me a base to work with. Then I took that base and realized the most powerful thing I had was those people. And you know, in sales, we said the only reason you go into a cold market is to get into another person's warm market. So how do I get into these folks' warm market? So, you know, once we got a couple hundred people, you know, listening regularly, you knew you had that core group. I started a contest, listener appreciation contest. I said, if you'll fill out this other form other than the one to be on the email list, I'll just use that as a database. And at the end of this year, if we hit 1,000 listeners, I'll pull somebody randomly off that list and I'll give them an iPod. That's how long ago this is. And I'll engrave it with "Be an ant, not a grasshopper" from me. And so then people got on board with that. And it was a great link building campaign because most people didn't go tell their brother. They went onto a forum or a blog or something and said, I'm watching, you know, listening to this guy at the Survival Podcast. Well, next thing you know, I'm number one for survival podcast in Google. The organic effect takes over. In that first 6 months to that end of the year where we did that contest, we hit 2,500 listeners. And by the end of the next year, we were at 25,000. And by the time we hit that, I didn't really do any conventional marketing ever again. I did social media, Facebook and Twitter. I have a YouTube channel that I kind of see, like, I don't consider myself a YouTuber, but I put content there because it funnels people in. And it's been all organic growth since then. And, you know, we're at a point now where we get about 200,000 daily downloads, which is, you know, a fairly significant size of a population of a city. And 10 years running. And then because of it, it's not just the raw number thing. It's the community model that we built. So the responsiveness of my audience is, I think, what is different than a lot of podcasts that maybe even have more listeners. People have 1 million downloads, but how responsive are those people? Or do they just have you in the queue and they listen to your 15-minute thing? So we have, our average sponsor has been with us 8 years. 8 years as a sponsor of a podcast. And that's just not something that generally happens, but it's because the audience is so responsive and so loyal. And then I think what really, like, when I was in consulting and marketing, I always had clients like, well, I want to be viral, but I don't want to lose control. Okay, that's not how this works. So by not trying to control everything, we've built all these sub-communities. We have the largest and most active Zello channel that there is on the Zello network. If you're familiar with Zello, it's kind of like a two-way radio com, set up your own channel type thing. That channel has been so successful, the Zello people have had conference calls with my moderators to add functions and features to Zello. I literally do nothing. Like, I started it and I got the heck out of the way as soon as there was good moderators taking care of it, and I left it alone. I built our old school PHP style forum back in the day. I don't touch that. I let the administrators, they monetize it. Whatever they can make, they can make. I don't touch that. I set up our Facebook group. I got out of the way. And all these other groups we set up, I've got out of the way. We started a nonprofit to do disaster response. I put a good board in place. I got out of the way. And I let these communities develop their own life. And that all feeds back into the primary community. So it's this community sub-community model that if you said, well, how would you build this in 2008? I would have went, I don't know. But as the opportunities came, I was smart enough to realize this is what you can do. Now look, see those people over there doing stuff? Let them alone. Get out of the way. Let them do that. And that's really, I think, the unique piece that is the TSP community and sub-communities. That's awesome. Yeah, it was by then. The first 6 months, I didn't take a dime out of it. I actually had some people that like were like wanting to do donations, and some of them, we did try to run a little small event that ended up getting canceled because of some logistics, and because of that, some people found out my PayPal account, and some people just sent me money. I sent it back. I'm like, I'm not a charity. I don't want to do a donation tip jar type thing. I'll figure something out. At about 6 months into it, I had. Right from the beginning, actually, I had our first sponsor, Safe Castle, who's now, this January, will be with us 10 years. They wanted to sponsor me back when I had like 200 listeners. And I was like, no, I'm not, no. Because if I take your money and I don't perform, you're not going to be happy. So in January, when I had a couple thousand listeners, I went to them and I said, look, I'll do this. I'm not promising a lot. I got to charge at least a couple hundred bucks a month or it doesn't make sense to do it. And they were fine with that. They said, like, we know where this is going. And I came up with a sponsor model that I still don't think anybody else is doing. I took all my moderators in my forum, and I made them a listener ad council. And I said, when I get a prospective sponsor, I'm going to basically consider you guys a wolf pack, and I'm going to throw them at you. And you get 48 hours to destroy them. Look up BBB, look up, you know, other forums, look up online reputation. And if you guys, if two out of, there's like 20 of them, if two or more of you say no, doesn't matter what I think, I won't take them. And that made it a really unique thing. Like, you had to qualify. And I'm like, I'm not saying you think the product's overpriced. I'm like, I want to give you a little guidance here. But, you know, do they take care of their customers? Do they have a bad reputation? Is what they're selling snake oil? And it took that responsibility out of my hands. That idea actually came from a Mother Earth news magazine, believe it or not. I was sitting there reading one of those because there's a lot of good kind of homesteading content in those magazines. And obviously, as a podcaster in that space, I want to know what everything I can. And somebody wrote in a letter that basically admonished them because they always have this cigarette company advertising all natural cigarettes. And they didn't think that really fit the Mother Earth News image very well. And you can debate whether it does or not. I didn't like the response. The response was, well, we sell advertising. And as long as the company's legal and legitimate, you know, we're not implying endorsement by selling them advertising. And I was like, no, you kind of are. You know, it's kind of exactly what you're doing is you're implying endorsement. So I'm like, I don't want to endorse anybody that sucks or doesn't meet with our ideals or is not going to take care of my customers. So by letting the moderators do that, and we did have two companies over the years, that's why we've even had some turnover. I fired them. They went into like the one company went kind of totally off the reservation nuts. With the fear-mongering stuff and selling this overpriced solar generator piece of junk that I'm like, nope, y'all are fired. And one of my early silver sponsors got into like network marketing type of thing, which in of itself isn't a problem, but the way they were doing it really, really was. So I've had two sponsors that I flat out said, we're terminating a relationship with you. And they don't believe you at first because, of course, that's not a real thing. You just say that. No, done. Right? So we had this little bit of sponsor income. And with what I was selling it for back then, it was about $24,000 a year. And I did that for a while. And then, because I sold out the sponsorships like almost immediately as soon as I launched that program, because people that were listening were in the space and going, I want to be part of this. And then it worked. And then I was building the audience. And I at some point, I'm like, okay, I need, like, this is never going to pay the bills in of itself. This is gas money. How do I grow this? And I kept getting these companies. I want to be a sponsor. I want to be a sponsor. I want to be a sponsor. I'm like, well, I can't have 50 sponsors. It dilutes the value of being a sponsor. So I came up with my membership program and I started going back. First, I went to all my sponsors because I wanted them to have first crack. I'm like, would you be willing to do a discount for my best customers? And anybody with a brain that understands incremental revenue is like, well, yes. So I created this private membership site where, among other things, you get discount codes to sponsors and what we call MSV partners, Member Support Brigade, MSV partners, if they're not official sponsors. And so then I could take all these companies that wanted to do business with us and go, can you do 5%? Can you do 10? You know, what can you do? Free shipping on orders over this. So then I built that program. And when I launched that program, in the first 4 days, we did $20,000 in business. And that's when I went, okay, no more of this misery at work. I'm selling out to my, I'm done. And I did it for a few months to make sure it wasn't just like a blip that would go away and make sure it was sustainable, because we were doing annual, monthly, or quarterly membership, and most people were doing annual. So it was like, will this come back? Will we keep selling? And we did. So that's when I approached my partners about 2 months into that program and said, I want to go away. And so I did that other 6 months. By the time I actually left, I wasn't making as much with the podcast as I was with my business, but I was making a good solid six-figure income. So it was a pretty easy decision to walk away. Kind of good in my space though, right? That's why the survival thing was like. So the other thing we did though is we created this concept of modern survivalism, and that term's everywhere now. But I wanted a hook that was mine that I could legitimately claim. So I started coming up with different ideas for what to call what we did to differentiate it from hiding in a bunker. And when I came up with modern survivalism, I'm like, that's – so I went on Google and did the quotation where you're looking for an exact match. And I found one exact match, and it was like the sentence ended with modern and started with survivalism. So it wasn't even really a phrase, and I'm like, okay, that's my thing. And we latched onto that, and that let us go beyond, you know, storing food and hiding from the blue helmet UN troops, right? So that we could talk about things like building a business. One of the most liberating things you can do. The reason I'm so passionate about that is I've experienced it multiple times in multiple ways in my life. And I know that nothing will give you more freedom and independence than having something of yours that you own that you control. So right away, we started talking about building businesses and adding marketing to your life. And if you didn't build a business, treating your job like you were a contractor, even if you weren't, you only had one customer. And how did you diversify out of that? And we talked about building a resilient life. And there's a lot that goes into that that's, you know, right in the core of the prepper space. But there's so much more than that. And, it turned into homesteading and permaculture and gardening and aquaponics and solar energy. And it's really kind of amazing how to make fuel that you actually burn in a car and how to make fuel that you might accidentally spill in your mouth, if you get my drift, right? So, like, we did all these things even very early on, and we've just, you know, matured over the years. And, you know, today if I launched it, I might call it the Lifestyle Design Podcast, because that's a thing now. Like, people use that terminology. You know, I'm like, I was kind of one of those special children. I was one of the few people who was dumb enough to go out and buy copies of Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week and give them to my employees. I mean, that's how passionate I am about getting people into doing their own thing. Because I was like, if they're going to leave, they're going to leave anyway. At least they'll leave right. And if they don't leave, then maybe they'll be a better employee if they think more like this. Because I don't care how you get your job done. I care that you get your job done. Sure. Yep. Listeners, really. This is a listener service. So, correct. But the sponsors and those who, you know, like, again, you only have so many room for show sponsors. So the companies beyond that group that want to be part of it, they are the primary value to the listener. So the way it works is a listener will sign up $50 a year. Sometimes I run sales. Sometimes I run a lifetime sale. So I do that a couple times, usually really once a year. Like today I did that, and we did $4,500 worth of sales in an hour. So, I mean, that was a nice little bonus that we paid ourselves for Christmas. But so that listener signs up for whatever duration, and they're on an automatic renewal because that's just smart from a business standpoint. Of course, they can cancel anytime they want. And they get a login to the private side of the site. They log into there. And the big value add, again, is we call it the benefits section. They click on benefits. And there's about 70 companies that offer discounts. Imagine if the AAA discounts that AAA says they give you were actually discounts, right? The stuff you actually use. That's kind of what our program is. We have discounts on, you know, firearms parts and components. We have discounts on seeds. We have discounts on plants. We have a couple that are kind of like general store of prepping type that have, you know, everything and anything you think of. Water filters. Berkey water filters are probably the premier water filter in the prepper space. We have a discount on those. So we have discounts on all these different products, and some of them are not really even prepper products. Like we have one, a company called EcoSense, and I'm like, people will dig that for their, they don't justify to their wives why they have this program. That works. We have one called Olive Basket, those infused olive oils and vinegar. So cooking products, etc. So we've just taken these, any company thinks they're a good fit, we'll look at them, and if they are, we'll say, okay, write your own blurb. If you do a membership program and you do discounts, I really encourage you come up with guidance, like word count, whatever. Make the customer write their own blurb. That way, if anybody doesn't understand something, it's their fault, not yours. You'll change it. You see what I'm saying? Like otherwise, like you craft it for them and the customer gets the wrong idea about what the discount means. So you make them write their own blurb. We drop them in there. And I shoot to add about, you know, 6 to 12 new partner companies a year. And some of them are small businesses. So you'll have some turnover if you do this. Either they'll stop doing it, or the guy will go off and do something else, or discontinue the only product he had discounted. My requirement is, one, I don't do a contract, but I expect kind of a virtual handshake. We agree to do this together for a year, so there's stability in my program. If it really doesn't work for you, I'll shut it off, but we go in with kind of the understanding that's the goal. And that the discount not be something you do all the time for everybody anyway. It has to be something that's exclusive. Doesn't mean you can't do it around the holidays or twice a year or something, but my people get access to it 24/7. And as long as they're willing to do that and it's a quality product and I trust the company, I'll bring them on board. And that makes the sale easy. Because if the customer who listens to you every day looks at the people doing the discounts and says, well, I buy from them already. And I don't buy from them, but I buy that product. And I'm happy to buy from them since they support us. And I use herbal supplements and I use this. And I do the math in my head, and I'm going to get $70 in discounts to give this guy $50, who I like anyway. Well, done. And as long as they're making a profit, they retain. I've had customers that are, you know, 8 years retained because it just, if you had something that's giving you $100 worth of discounts, you're paying $50 for, like, you have poor financial sense if you cancel that product. Correct. Yeah. If you're going to use that stuff, right? You know, but if you're listening to the show, you're probably planting trees. So if you get 10% off, I mean, if you've priced fruit trees, but they're not cheap. So it's really easy to think in that one order, you're going to save $20, $30. So that one order a year is halfway there. So yeah, it works really well. Now I do get occasionally, because I will go out, I don't really go out and look for guests. I kind of let guests come to me because that keeps it all in the community. You came on my show because somebody reached out to you and said, hey, you should go check out this and possibly be on there. And I really like that. But when it comes to vendors, I see it as my job to go find them. or I'll buy something and go, this is really cool. And then I have an instant hook with the seller, because when I contact them, I'm not just a prospect or somebody prospecting them. I'm a customer. I bought your stuff. I like your stuff. I think my audience would like your stuff. Can I tell you about this? But when I make that pitch, the biggest objection I'll get is, well, what if somebody posts it in a forum somewhere and we get hundreds of orders from people that aren't in your program? Well, first of all, that's my problem, not yours, right? Because I'm the one selling access to it. Some of the smaller business people, you realize like your margins are way too thin if you can't come up with something in a program where you get full discretion. And that's another problem I've had. I had a guy recently with Stills that I wanted to bring on board, and he's like, I can't discount them from where I'm selling them. I'm like, then you need to raise your price. You know, and I'm just looking at him going, he's beautiful. His artwork. He's an artist. He's going to be out of business in a year because he's not making enough money if he can't figure out some deal to make. But the whole concept of it getting out into the out of the ecosystem and into the going native on the net, if you get hundreds of orders, that's good for you if you've structured this right. And if you ever think that it happened, just tell me and I'll change the code. It's easy now because now it's like we have 200,000 listeners. We have over 10,000 paid members. And we've been doing it 10 years and it's never happened. But in the beginning, that was a difficult hurdle because I want to deal with small companies here. You go out and try to deal with somebody like a Cabela's or something in this set, it'd be great. But they don't see it as incremental revenue. And they have a legitimate view in that, right? They probably know a lot of the people they're going to give a discount to would have bought from them anyway. The small business person realizes you're offering incremental revenue. I'm giving you the ability to advertise your product on a set rate. You know, if you knew you could get sales on Google AdWords for $5 a sale, would you do it? Yeah. Then do a 5% discount on a $100 product because you can't lose. So it does take an education sometimes of the customer, or I should say the vendor partner, but I think it's a good model for a lot of podcasters. Yeah. Yeah, the pitch to the customer, that's how that goes. And I usually do it about 3 times a week, so it's not over the head beating them up with it. Sometimes it's really short. Sometimes I do actually explain it a little bit more for new listeners. Sometimes I'll hit them with an email. If I do a lifetime sale, like I said, I usually do that once a year. I'll do 15 or 20 of them. That'll have a couple posts leading up to it. If I do a sale, you know, I'll do $35 for the first year. That I'll kind of promote a week in advance. And it's kind of cool because you tell people, you know, you should join the MSB. Don't do it today. And they're like, wow, he's telling me not to join so I can get a better deal next week. And it buys you credibility when you're willing to pre-advertise that. But it also kind of primes the sale so the sale becomes a success. I've done hater sales. I love hater sales. So a hater sale will be like, we had one guy who was like a militant vegan on Facebook who was just harassing me about everything that we did and with, you know, with regenerative agriculture and stuff like that, because we talk a lot about that stuff. And finally, I'm like, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to do a bacon sale in Travis's honor. So I said, if you would commit to eating an extra pound of bacon and use the discount code bacon and give a gift of bacon to somebody, that I would give you, you know, the first year for $25. So we did it for like a day before I went on vacation. We sold over 100 of them, so it was a little over $2,500. So I pretty much paid for my vacation with a hater sale. That was fun, and people had kicks out. Some people bought like a membership for their dog just to be part of that, you know. it's a lot of fun if you get creative with whatever it is you have to sell. I'm not in the product business, so I kind of have a one trick pony with that thing. But my other revenue model is as an Amazon affiliate. And we have, you know, that went from like a little bit of side income to a business unit. And that became successful with reviewing products, putting them on the website, but making a commitment to people that if you see this product on my website reviewed, you probably can come find it at my house. And doing very in-depth reviews. And we got a little dicey with like the Amazon terms of service. We got a couple Amazon nastygrams about like telling people too much about being an affiliate and things like that. And we backed it off. But because we were doing solid actual reviews, and they could see, well, this guy reviewed this thing on this day. He sold 200 of them okay, he's legit. You know, he's not scamming the system. But that's our product side. I don't really like that because it's kind of being a digital sharecropper, but it pays really good. One a day, and I write them myself. Now, in the beginning, when I started this program, I started doing it about 3 years ago, and I was churning out one a day. Now, I probably turn out two new ones a week, and I recycle ones that people have liked. So, yeah, I wrote all of those. And, you know, that goes back to years of doing copywriting and marketing, and you know, I'll just bring it around. Sometimes I just do it. Sometimes I'll tell them it's coming around again. Sometimes I just go, yeah, you know, last time we ran that indoor grow light, we sold 100 of them. It's spring. People are doing their, you know, indoor planting now. So I'll just run that again. Sometimes I will find a product that goes on sale and I'll say, I'm bringing this around today because it's marked down $25. Today, I'm selling the hell out of a product, a little LED lantern called the Siege Lantern from Streamlight. Because it's on a lightning deal for $20. It normally sells for like $66. So I didn't even do a review of that one. I just did a quick, like, hey, guys, this thing is – because I know that product and my audience go together. So I added that today. And, you know, we're selling the hell out of them because it's an easy sale because it's Christmas time. It's on sale really cheap. My concern with Amazon is my sales have gone up and my income's gone down. Last year – they were paying a tiered payout for affiliates. We were selling enough product that we were making a full 8.5% every month. And most products at the end of last year shifted to a flat 4%. So our Amazon income got cut almost in half this year, selling just as much, or if not more. So that kind of sucks, but to be able to sell anything and everything that your audience could ever want, and know that if they don't like it, they can return it, all that good stuff. There isn't anything better, which is partly, you know, why they did it. The other part of it is, you know, you say what you want about being a trillion-dollar company, but they make like a 2% margin. So they only have so much that they can give to an affiliate. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do have a Patreon page. I really don't need one, but people were asking about it, so I always think the best way to do something is to set it up. It's kind of a redundant thing with my members program, because Patreon's kind of like a members program for people that don't know how to run one. But, you know, it's a few $100. There's people that don't want the membership, or they want to be able to set their own what they give you or whatever, so, you know, that's a few $100. I make, you know, $500-$600 a month from AdSense content through my YouTube channel, just because we have enough of a viewership that's what happens. And that business is weird too. Like, there'll be some stupid little video you do because you're mad, and that'll be one that makes you like $75 a month. I got one from, like, I love DeWalt tools, and so I saw all these negative reviews about the new 20-volt products when it came out, and the old DeWalt chargers, you just threw the battery in the charger, right? So the new charger, everybody that was an installed base on the 18-volt that switched to 20 just threw the battery in the charger, and it might work that way or it might not. But what you're supposed to do is click it in like you're installing it into a tool. So I did this like minute and 30-second video basically saying, stop hating on DeWalt. This is how it works. And DeWalt, you idiot, should like put this instruction so people stop leaving you bad reviews. And a couple like home improvement blogs, and I'll pick that thing up, and it gets thousands of views a month, and, you know, there's a commercial on it. So that'll make me $50-$70 a month off that one stupid video. So if you're YouTubing it, you never know where you're going to hit it. But, man, people got hit with that too hard. Anything that's in politics, that's on the right or libertarian-leaning, you know, those got or gun content, they all got slammed. I really don't do that on YouTube very much, so it didn't affect me. But it's also not, you know, it's nice to have money, but it's not – money that I really count on. It's kind of bonus money. Really, it's like retirement money. You know, okay, that the AdSense check came in, send it over to financial advisor. Occasionally, I'll have a segment on the podcast, and I'm like, that was a really good rant, you know, and I'll just grab that out and throw some stills and make it a YouTube video. So there are some podcast segments to get on there. One of my expert council members, Charles Humble Mechanic, he's a whole success story in himself as a YouTuber. He usually takes his segments when he records them for the show and does them as a video and puts them on his channel. So that kind of ends up on there. Most of my YouTube stuff, though, is me messing around with my ducks in the backyard, or I built a new aquaponic system, or I'll do a Q&A or something like that. It really isn't directly tied to the podcast, but I always pitch my podcast. You know, I'll always say something at the end, like, if you like this YouTube channel, you'll probably like my podcast. You know, I'll say, well, you can get to my podcast by going to survivalpodcast.com or to tspc.co. Yes, co, it really works. Try it. Just find out if it works, you know. Or all the cool kids are putting it in their phone, try to put it in yours. So I see YouTube more as a funnel, you know, and I do have some cross-pollination back and forth, but my goal is for it to bring people in. And there's some other things that we've done over the years that aren't directly related to the podcast. Did a caging company with someone in the you know, for quail and stuff like that. So I've always been a serial entrepreneur, but honestly, the membership program is where I should put 90% of my effort, because it's 90% of my revenue. And it's a very good way to, as a podcaster, to mitigate the potential for loss. If I just flat piss off 10% of the MSB and they all quit tomorrow, I won't be happy about it, but I still have an income. You know, if I piss off half my sponsors and I'm getting all my money from them, I've got a problem. So a little bit from a lot of people in a recurrent model is a very stable model. It's why we've been able to grow our revenue despite things like Amazon cutting it in half every year consistently for the 9 years that we've been monetized out of the 10 years we've been in business. Yeah, definitely. I mean, kind of what you're saying there, I think, is the way I phrase it is that audio is the most powerful form of marketing known to man. Audio is the only content delivery system that you can actually put content to somebody while they're engaged in another activity. So if a person's going to read, they have to sit down and look at it. Like, you really shouldn't read while you drive, right? Or if they're going to watch a video, they have to devote 100% of their attention to it. With podcasting and using audio, you're able to, guys driving in his car, he's listening to your show. He's working out at the gym, listening to your show. Sitting in a deer blind, listening to your show. You know, whatever it is, they can multitask with it. And I think it makes it a lot more sticky. And this is why, like, if you remember back in the 80s, one of the big 80s and 90s even, big things that as direct marketers did, they made audio cassette tapes. And they'd want to sell, you know, Pignogenol or something, and they'd make this, you know, 45-minute tape, and they'd mail those tapes as a sales tool. Podcasting lets you make a million of those for free every day if you want to. And that is what makes podcasting, to me, the most powerful form of marketing. So then you got to figure out, well, what am I marketing? You know, I'm marketing a lifestyle, and these are the things that go along with it. You're marketing having something of your own. And these are the things that go along with it. So if a person's out there and the side hustle they want to dig into is podcasting, that's the way you need to come at it, if that makes sense. I'm losing you, Nick. I'm losing your you're fading in and out on me, so I'm not really hearing what you're asking. Okay, so the question is, do I ever take a vacation, right? So yeah, I mean, I'm about to take a big one every year, and this goes back to my years in telecommunications. Most companies I worked for back then kind of did a shutdown between Christmas and New Year's. It became a tradition in my family. So Friday will be my last show of the year, and I will shut down until January 2nd, and I pretty much do that every year. I usually take one, you know, me time, real vacation with my wife a year. We usually take 10 days off. And what I'll usually do now with having over 2,300 episodes, I'll do what I call rewinds. So I'll pull out, if I'm going to be gone for, you know, 2 weeks, I'll pull out 10 shows from the past, and I will take my original commercial content out of them, the advertisements, the standard intro, and I'll record 5 or 6 minutes of new content, what's changed, what I was thinking at this time, that type of thing. And I'll amend that to the beginning of it. And that means I can, you know, do 5 of those in about 2 hours. And I'll preload those with WordPress to publish, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So when I leave, there's a show every day. It's just a rewind. It's the same thing that, you know, the talk radio people do. They'll play, you know, a classic episode or whatever. What works really good for what I do, though, is since most of it's evergreen and it's not temporal based, it's not what's going on in the news, that episode is just as relevant, you know, today as it was 5 years ago. So that's how I manage my vacations. And I do speaking engagements, and those, they're not vacations for me, but they're vacations as far as the audience is concerned. I'll be gone, and I do the same thing there. But I definitely have downtime. Now the Christmas downtime, there's just no shows. I'll see you in January. Okay, again, you're breaking on me a little bit, but I think you're asking me about, like, what type of a team do I have? I have no employees. I don't want any employees. I definitely am a smaller business than I could be if I had built, you know, a more merchandise-centric company with a team of employees. I did that for 20 years of my life. It made me want to take a cheese grater to my face. I hated having employees because I am so driven. I expect people that work for me to be driven the way that I am, and that's something every entrepreneur has to come to terms with. They won't be. If you get 1 out of 100 that are, you're lucky, and most of them go off and do something of their own. So I rely on my community. My biggest asset as far as a team beyond the audience, so I consider part of the team, would be my expert counsel. And those are the 14 individuals that all have a specialized area that help me produce content once a week for a show. And then I have, like, the admins in the forum. I gave them the forum. I let them monetize that. They have the ad revenue from that. Anything else they can come up with. Well, they also do all of my technical work. Now, I pay them for that separately, but I run 2 dedicated servers with failover. I know what that is, but I don't know how to do it. So if I need something done, they take care of it. They send me an invoice, and I pretty much out-task anything that I want to do. I did a site redesign recently. One of those gentlemen did it, but I had other people that could have. He was just willing to and available at the time. I really, it's me and my wife and my dogs and the ducks. That's really the team here, right? So the dog sits on the floor while I podcast and warms my feet up. My wife does all my booking for me. When a guest submits a form, she takes it from there. You know, Wednesday morning, like magic, a form shows up on my desk. I research the guest. And by the time we're doing the interview at 1 o'clock, I know enough about them to do the show intelligently. We stay very, very lean on it, so we have no cost. Our costs are all, you know, web hosting and anything else I can convince the government's related to the show, like meals out or taking a vacation or something like that. There's nobody to pay. There's no, you know, what's your margin on a membership? I don't know. The biggest expense is the $1.40 that PayPal or Stripe charges me to run the charge. There's no real cost. Like, there is a cost to deliver that, but the cost is the same for 1,000 members as it is for 10,000, right? So the margin gets disproportionately higher the more you get. So we don't really rely on a lot of labor, and I don't ever want to do that again for the rest of my life. God bless the people that do. People need jobs so they can buy my membership, right, and support your show and what have you. Because there's 2 things you can't sell to, and one is stupidity, and the other is poverty. You can sell the ignorance because you can correct it. You can't sell the stupid, and you can't sell the poor. So we need employees as entrepreneurs, even if they're not in our business. But I don't like managing them. I don't like, and I think part of it is I want so much more for people than they want for themselves, that it makes me miserable to see the potential in someone who won't step up and realize it for themselves. And it also sucks to sit there and watch somebody sitting there like a bump on a log and not doing nothing while they draw a paycheck out of your pocket. Well, we're definitely going to make another 10 years unless I keel over and die or something. We did a party this summer for audience members at a restaurant in Fort Worth. And, you know, I had people fly in for a 3-hour party from like LA and Chicago and what have you. And I was like, if I ever needed kind of a kick in the ass, so to speak, to understand how important what we're doing, it was how humbling that type of thing was. So we're definitely going to continue doing what we're doing. I think if anything's going to be different, it's going to be that I'm going to be more focused on just doing what we're doing. Over the years, like every mistake I made was, you know, oh, this is a good niche. I'll go into that too, and I'll get a partner to do that with me, and I'll back it, and I'll market it. And then, oh God, that's even worse than an employee. So I really don't have any, you know, big plans for something new or different. Like, we've refined this machine, and we know what it does well. I definitely want to continue to bring in new discount vendors for the MSB because that's the value add. I want to evolve the content. I certainly am always looking for people that I can add to the expert council, as long as they bring something that I don't already have, right? Because you can only have so many people on the same thing, kind of start stepping on each other. So how I can enhance that, like I said recently, we brought a vet in, like a veterinarian, not a veteran. And we brought a retired law enforcement officer to talk about, you know, dealing with legal issues and working with the police and, you know, how to handle being pulled over and stuff like that. So I want to always continue to build that. But my goal has stopped being make the company bigger. Let's make more money. Let's grow our revenue. I want to see some growth. So I feel if you're not growing, you're failing. There always should be some growth there. But what I'm measuring my success now is, how many Jack, you're a jerk emails do I get a week? Which has kind of become a joke where people email me and go, because of you, we were prepared for a blackout and we got through a layoff. And like, that is now the currency that gives me the feel-good side of the business. Or I started a business because of you and we're being successful now. And I want to send you a product so you can look at it. And it's really not, you can tell that like the guy's not even, he's not doing it so you'll promote it. He's doing it because he's like, I want to show you what I did because of you. You know, that's what I want. I've said people think it's kind of narcissistic. I really don't think it is. What I want is immortality, but I don't want it in my name. I want it in actions of others. I want the businesses that I inspired to be started this year to 5 years from now be inspiring other people to start business, and the people that we've inspired to plant trees to go out and inspire other people to plant trees. And if, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, whatever from now, I'm pushing up daisy, so to speak. If there's still businesses running and businesses being established that somehow connect back to what we do, if people are still out planting gardens, if still people are still teaching hard skills to kids instead of just everything being an iPhone, if people are still, you know, being prepared because someone told somebody that sold somebody, that type of thing, then the goals we have really have been accomplished. I really think that like the best thing any company can do, and I've only seen a few that are willing to step out and do it, is to set a goal so beyond what they're capable of ever actually achieving that they achieve more than they ever thought that they could. It's the old thing where if you set the bar for the hurdler at 6 feet and he can only make 5'1", he makes 5'7", right? He still knocks it over at 6 feet, but he'll jump higher because he's trying harder. One of my sponsors, Western Botanicals, is a good example of this. You know, they're an herbal supplement company. Their goal isn't to, you know, reach 50 million in sales or whatever. Their goal is they want to put an herbalist in every home in America. They're never going to do that, but they're damn sure going to try. And so that's kind of what the future holds for me. Let's set the most ridiculous goals we can for ourselves, and then let's have a lot of fun not quite getting there. My number one tip is go out and pick something and try it. You hear a lot of success stories on Nick's show, or if you come on my show, you'll hear a lot of success stories too. What people tend to forget is that for every success, the person that had it probably had 20 or 30 failures. I did a lot of things. Some of them failed. Some of them succeeded until the rug was pulled out from underneath me. I made a ton of money in Google AdSense at one time, back when that was a thing. And, you know, it went from $7,000 in income to $700 to $70. And so we've all had failures. But what changes things in your life is saying, you know, I was listening to your show, Nick, and there was a guy talking about flipping stuff on Amazon that he bought on Amazon. I'm like, oh, my, what? Like, that sounds so – what? You did what? And, like, did it over and over again. But he tried it. Or the guy that did the yard sales and was selling mostly, like, through eBay and stuff like that. I'm like, go do something. Pick something. We were on my show together. I said, you know, I kind of get tired of hearing people's ideas because it becomes intellectual masturbation. But what I love is when somebody hears an idea and they say the words, well, I can do that. And it's in that action that you'll find the next step. And in my career, I've had a good fortune to meet a lot of really cool people. One guy I met was a dude named Valery Asimov. This guy was a KGB agent in the former Soviet Union. He was also a Russian Olympic athlete. He was on the Russian judo team back in the early 80s. And he said one of the big things that the Russians did with their athletes that was different than what everybody else did is they taught the strategy of survival versus the strategy of victory. If you were in some sort of a competitive, you know, combat type sport like judo or boxing, the goal was to survive the next move, the next round, the next second. And if you survive long enough, the opportunity to win would present itself. That's what your folks need to be doing. Get in to these different activities and get in with the mindset of, I'm going to get this done. I'm going to learn how to produce content. I'm going to learn how to edit. I'm going to learn how to write an ad. I'm going to learn how to, whatever it is, and survive and survive and survive. And sooner or later, you will find the thing that is your passion and your talent, where those two converge. And when you find that, grab onto it, run with it, and don't stop. And if you do that, you'll find something that works for you. And if you don't, get used to working for other people, because they're really the only two choices you have today. Nick, thanks for having me on today. And like I said, when you're on my show, you want to come back anytime, let me know, fill out a form, we'll get you on the air. And thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to your audience today.